Georgia Dow and Renee Ritchie are here to show off the new iPads and the new iPhones. It's tiny. Engadget is here to talk about the trouble with online communities. And Microsoft apologizes for its new chatbot. Or is it apologizing for humans? We're not sure. All that and more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1478, recorded Friday, March 25th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you will actually like. Connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/TNT. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today, the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is on vacation, but today I am joined by both Georgia Dow and Renee Ritchie from iMore. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so glad that you guys are both here with me. We're not going to do all Apple news for those of you who are afraid of that. Renee and Georgia both know lots of things about lots of other things besides Apple, but we will come cover some Apple news.
And there's no truth that it takes two of us to equal the height of Jason Howell. Totally.
Maybe a little bit of truth to that.
A little bit of truth. For me, a little bit of truth.
So why don't you guys say a little bit about iMore real quick before we get started, just in case anyone has never heard either of you.
iMore is a website where we try to help everyone who owns Apple stuff get the most out of their stuff. So iPhones, iPads, Apple TVs, Apple Watches, all these kind of things. We just want to help people out and make sure they have a great experience.
Great. That's a lot of fun. We have fun
while we do.
And in case someone has never seen you on the show, Georgia, tell us what else you do besides iMore.
So I'm also a psychotherapist by day. So I treat anxiety, depression, parenting, and other things to help people live better lives. And I also have an anxiety videos website that helps people if they want to treat their anxiety at home.
I think my parenting needs treatment sometimes, always. So thank you. So let's get started with the news. It's Friday, and if you're planning to watch some Netflix this weekend, you might want to do it on Wi-Fi, especially if your mobile provider is Verizon or AT&T. The Wall Street Journal reports that for over 5 years, Netflix has been sending lower resolution video streams to certain mobile customers, and they say they're doing it so that those customers don't exceed their data caps. Now, I know that Netflix and regulations are different in Canada, but I think that these allegations first surfaced because of a request from a Canadian regulator. So what do you guys think about this story? Do you think that this throttling is a violation of net neutrality?
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, Netflix keeps on talking about, you know, that they're really neutral and they believe in net neutrality. And yet, you know, here they are doing their own set of throttling, which they say is in order to, you know, help their customers with data caps. And it's funny because this is the one time that being Canadian actually works out better for Canadian Netflix owners, which rarely does it ever
better,
do.
The minute I got LTE, I went through that cap watching Netflix really quick. So it's kind of like, what is better, making my eyeballs happy with super high-dense video or making my wallet happy by not spending all my data?
Right. Though I don't really notice the difference from myself. When I watched the videos between those that were throttled versus unthrottled, it's not a huge difference for me. And so I think that, you know, Netflix, now that they've, you know, come out with talking about that, they're going to set different ways so that you can choose what, you know, how many bits you want yourself, which I think is a better way to go about it. So
I grew up in the era of 320p cat videos on YouTube. So anything is a bonus to me at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that, I mean, you can go through your caps so quickly watching videos. And, you know, speaking of parenting, that's a lesson that you have to teach your children, because once they, you know, have their own device and, you know, you have to teach them, well, just hook up to Wi-Fi whenever you're at home. You know, you have to explain it, because you can watch one movie and run through your data cap depending on what it is.
It's totally true. I mean, like Apple famously, because they're a really controlling company, they will tell you, you can't watch this on cellular. You have to work really hard to do it. It always says, oh, this is too big. You probably should go onto Wi-Fi.
Yeah, and people don't really understand about how much data is used in a video. And so most people think that nothing's going to happen, that they can watch as much as they want. And so I think that in some ways it's protecting people against themselves.
So do you think Netflix was not being honest by not revealing this right away?
Well, I think that they weren't. I don't think that it was a malicious thought on their part, because then if, you know, and I think it was beneficial to them, because if you don't run through your data cap, then you're not going to be angry and you'll be able to watch more Netflix, which helps them out. But I think that, you know, they should have been straightforward with right away saying, this is what we're doing for these reasons. Whenever you try to do something behind the scenes and then get called out for it and then you open up about it, people have a little bit more distrust for your brand. And that's really damaging to Netflix.
That's what I mean. Netflix is famous for this in general. Part of their technology is that they will initially start showing you lower resolution things so you can watch faster. And then when they sort of stabilize it, they'll pump up the higher bit rates. And some people hate that. They say, oh, Netflix looks blocky when I watch it. And something like Hulu maybe looks perfect right away because they're not doing the same sort of tier up and tier down. But that's sort of foundational technology. HTTPS live streaming, for example, is built on the ability to serve different quality video based on the available bandwidth. So I think that's something that they should absolutely be candid about. But it is technology that's meant to protect us and data. And all those, the sort of both our wallets and our eyes.
Yeah. And if they just started out with everyone that had less bits per second, and then you had the choice, if you understood technology and you knew how much data you had, you could upgrade it. I think that that would be something that would make everyone feel
it lands on binge on. I'm so in. I'm just watching it 24/7. Get ready, T-Mobile.
So when I was reading this, there was someone talking about the Apple TV and how they do Netflix streaming different. Like, is there, I know this is a different, because we're talking about being on Wi-Fi, but is there a different way if I'm watching Netflix through my Apple TV versus through my Roku? Am I going to get a better picture from one for the other?
So, I mean, this is kind of controversial because I don't know if Apple's ever given an official statement, but it's sort of understood that Apple pays money behind the scenes to sort of carry Netflix forward and make sure that everybody has the best availability for it. So they'll, instead of running it through a bunch of different internet hubs, Apple will sort of pay to put it on the best possible networks at all times, so everyone gets the fastest and most solid signal, best experience with Netflix.
All right, well, let's move on to another Apple story. Recode reports that Apple is asking for a delay in the case of the drug trafficker in Brooklyn to find out if the FBI's way of cracking into the San Bernardino shooter's phone will work on this other phone, too. The New York case also relies on the All Writs Act. And the Brooklyn case was seen as a boon at first for Apple because the judge said that the All Writs Act couldn't be used, but then the Justice Department asked for the Brooklyn case to be overturned. This case is also different because it's an iPhone 5S running iOS 7. So how are these two cases different and similar?
Different in that technologically, iOS 7 is in the very early stages when Apple started putting complete encryption, as Steve Gibson would call it, making it into a little crypto brick. So it is more vulnerable to things like jailbreaking and other ways of accessing the data. 5S, though, it has the secure enclave. It has the chip that does things like Touch ID that lets you actually hardware encrypt the phone. So it's not a matter of just scrambling data anymore. They just throw away the keys and that data is never accessible anymore. So it's a much harder device to get into than the 32-bit iPhone 5C that they had in San Bernardino.
So what do you make of Apple delaying this other Brooklyn case? Why do you think they're doing that?
They sort of felt really ambushed by the FBI when it started with the San Bernardino case, because Apple has a long history of working with the FBI to provide all the information they can. And then the All Writs Act was far more overreaching. They basically wanted Apple to create, as we've heard, you know, over and over again, a new version of iOS that would make it faster and easier enforcement and everybody else, by the way, to brute force passcodes. And other people started lining up. They're like, if we can get the All Writs Act to do this, because it's the job of law enforcement to do everything they possibly can. And, you know, like some people think they're being overreaching or they're trying to invade our privacy. That's their job. Their job is to go as hard and fast into the legal limits as they possibly can. And the legal limits for this stuff is fuzzy. So the judge in the New York case said this was an egregious violation of privacy and threw it out. The Justice Department is appealing that. But in the meantime, Apple wants to stay and see that if the same solution arrived by the FBI, basically some guy in his garage jailbreaking the phone using forensics tools, will work for this case too, because then the government will not proceed with the All Writs Act request. And it's a complete battle for precedent in this case, because once the precedent is set, if it goes in Apple's way, the FBI is going to be really nervous. If it goes in the FBI's way, then I think Apple will be really nervous.
Right. But either way, this is not something that's going to be going away. We're going to be dealing with privacy issues and, you know, expect that there'll be new laws and set, you know, so that, you know, law enforcement can have all the tools they want. And we have to kind of find out, you know, where does our privacy stay and what is important to having us? Because unfortunately, if our phones are less secure, our phones are less secure to everyone, to other countries, even the government themselves. And so this is a really important precedent for everyone to kind of, you know, find out about.
Well, yeah, the best analogy I can give is that the FBI thought that they had an ideal card, an ideal position to start a giant game of chicken. And rather than driving off the road, Apple turned around and drove right back at them as fast as they could. And then it became, you know, neither side could give in, because if the other side got the precedent, that was sort of it for this generation. And the FBI ultimately swerved. They would rather not have the judge rule at all in this case right now than rule against them. And now we're in this sort of holding pattern, and everyone is afraid of what's going to happen next.
So that's what you think, that they swerved in this game of chicken. I know you mentioned there was like some guy in his garage. What about the news reports about like this Israeli forensics company being the one that broke, that will break into the phone? Do you?
Yeah, that's what I mean, like an Israeli forensic company, 12-year-old guy in Eastern Europe. I mean, there's really no difference at this point. An iPhone 5C, if you can't jailbreak it, they could take it to Fort. And I know it's easy to say this, but they could take it to the NSA in Fort Meade, and the NSA could use a zero-day exploit to get into it. You know, theoretically, people jailbreak new versions of iOS all the time. That's what Apple is talking about. It's hard enough to keep people out when they do everything they can to make it secure. So can you imagine how hard it'll be to keep people out when they're forced to put vulnerabilities into it?
Right.
Well, I've heard both of you talk so eloquently about this for the last month. And, you know, we've all been talking about how having the conversation around privacy is what's so important. Do you think people generally are sort of getting tired of hearing about it? Or do you think that that people have really had their minds changed about the importance of what's on their phone and the importance of their privacy and what the government can and can't do in terms of what's on your phone?
I have a question for Georgia about this, actually, because I don't know if I've ever asked her this. Because to me, like, the minute we'd said what we were saying, people kept telling us that we were helping terrorists. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, no, not helping terrorists. Imagine this country where they're at war with their own citizens and they use this to round up and execute dissidents. That would make me feel, you know, horribly bad as well. So it's emotional, but I think it's too easy just to say that, you know, one side is good and one side is bad.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to privacy, it's very, the government used a very emotional argument, which makes us think about, you know, well, this is to protect us. And right away, that makes our analytical part of our brain not really thinking out the answers. We just want to keep our safety. And the fastest way to give up your privacy or things that are important to you is by threatening your own safety or the safety of your children. And I think that most people thought two things. One is that I don't mind if the government goes onto my phone. I'm doing nothing wrong. And the second thing is that it would never happen to me. And so because of that, I think that we thought of a very, you know, singular use case, and we didn't really think about the ramifications that would have to a full society and culture at large. Because unfortunately, once you give up your privacy or your safety, you're not getting it back. It's really hard to make then laws to go back and, you know, make us safe. Once your data from a phone is gone, and we keep everything on our phone, we keep where our children are, we keep our health information, we keep our banking information, the people we talk to, our money, everything is there. And so once it's given out, and even huge security companies, they have breaches, and it's really difficult even to keep that safe. And, you know, the thing is that then that can be used against you in order to sway. If people find out what websites you go to and then can use that to say, you know what, I think that you should vote in a certain way.
Just trying to figure out who you're blackmailing here, me or Megan.
Well, I'm grabbing, I have your phone right now.
Well, let's move on. Jessica Condit writing in Engadget had an excellent piece about suicide in the gaming community, and specifically the game journalism community. The story was surrounded Take This, which is a blog that was started by two editors who'd worked with Matt Hughes, who was a game journalist who committed suicide in 2012. It's a really important read. I highly recommend it. One sentence that struck me that I wanted to ask you, Georgia, about, it says that research shows that the more educated or technically sophisticated a person is, the less likely they are to seek help for mental issues. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, it's really quite sad, but I think that if you feel that you're really intelligent, we have this bias that happened from in the 60s and 70s that if you were smart enough, you wouldn't feel sad and you wouldn't get stressed and you wouldn't be depressed. And we had demonized mental illness for a really long time. And so we didn't understand how normal it is. It could happen to absolutely anyone. It doesn't mean that you're smarter or smarter or stronger. It wouldn't happen to you. And that's not the case. So a lot of people that, know that they're exceptionally intelligent may say, you know what, but I don't want the judgment or the stigma that's going to go along. And so they don't seek help. And unfortunately, if my car breaks down, the best person for me to bring it to, because I have zero knowledge in fixing a car, is a mechanic. And, if sometimes we need help as well, and if I'm sick, I would go to a doctor. And we need to start speaking about it. And that's why Take This is so wonderful, because it opens up the conversation to say, you know what? One is this could happen to anyone. There's nothing wrong with you if you deal with this. And we can talk about it, and there's support. And I think that that's the beautiful thing that comes out with having sites start to say, you know what, let's open a conversation. Let's have a safe space where no one feels stigmatized, because we never used to talk about this. People that are dealing with different issues in mental illness, and there are so many of them, and it happens so often to anyone that, people are like, you know what, this is something that we shouldn't keep hidden anymore.
So do you think to some extent that do-it-yourself attitude that a lot of tech people have, they think of that the same way as their own brain or their own mental health? Like, well, I I'm playing a game, I'm going to figure it out. We think of gamers as, I'm going to, we'll keep working at this till I figure it out myself. Is that what's going on, do you think, when people aren't seeking help for mental health issues?
I think that for people that deal in technology, we do have a greater propensity to anxiety and depression. And I think that it's a many faceted issue as to why that is the case. I think that one is that often people that are avoidant to certain issues will play a video game or just work on their coding. And so they kind of are able to avoid that for a certain amount of time. And then, after a while, if you're dealing something, you're just kind of, it's one drop in a bucket until you are highly overwhelmed. And then you need serious help, but then it's so much more difficult to climb out of the bucket. And so I think that that's one of the pieces to it, more than just the feeling that, because they're good at other things, they should be good at this. But that's another play at it as well.
So do you think gaming, I know you're also a gamer, do you think gaming can be a good therapy for someone who's suffering from mental illness, alongside getting professional help?
It's many more facets, I think, than that. I don't think that there's any one use case. If you're dealing with anxiety and you're stressed out and you just need a break, I think that gaming can be wonderful for that. It's the time that you can take your own break. You're not going to be ruminating about the worries in the world. I think that if you are feeling excluded, isolated, and depressed, I think that gaming then can become a crutch. You're not going to reach out to people. You're not going to talk to someone else. And because the game will give you a feeling, so when you reach an achievement in a game, you get a sense of dopamine. That's that feeling of happiness, like, yay, I got that sword. Woohoo, I beat this person. But that will keep you sustained until you stop playing the game, and then you'll go back down the regular route, and you'll almost become dependent upon it. Plus, then we can talk about, which we'll be talking about later, but there's also a lot of maliciousness that happens in gaming, a lot of mean comments that could happen on a game, which could make you feel even more angry. And it's kind of a maladaptive technique for dealing with that. And so in some ways gaming can be good, and in some ways gaming can be bad, because you won't know to seek help until you're feeling really, really bad. And you don't want to have anything, even a video, to be your avoidance technique. And that's when I always say, if you have to game in order to get through the day, then we're probably dealing with a different issue.
Right. Well, I highly recommend this Engadget article. And like you said, it's really important to talk about this and you know, not keep it a secret as we did for many generations. And our next story is inspired by Angus, who listens to our show from West Vancouver, BC, Canada. Angus expressed concern about the lack of accessibility news that we reported on the show. And he said that we mostly report what's in the regular media, which also avoids accessibility content. And he's right. So here's a story from yesterday that I missed about Google's new accessibility scanner. It lets you scan an app for issues that might make the app less accessible. Then you can suggest changes to the developer or make the changes to the app itself, even if you don't have technical skills to do this. So what do you guys think? Is there some equivalent to this on iOS?
So iOS is interesting. Apple internally has an entire team. They have an accessibility team, and it's similar to the performance team, which makes sure apps are working well, and the security team, which makes sure they're locked down. And that team's job is to go into every app made by Apple and to make sure that that accessibility layer, which includes making it friendly and labeled for screen readers, making it support things like hearing aid, making it support the different tools for motor accessibility, all of that works. And Apple provides a tremendous amount of developer tools. Now, there are some cases, for example, some developers famously went and rewrote their entire app as almost like a game. And those are totally opaque to accessibility. So there are apps, and the accessibility community is amazing. We started doing a lot more accessibility features about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And they have been incredible. We have actually imore.com/accessibility now, and they are incredibly supportive. People like Stephen Aquino and so many people have been helping us with this stuff that they love to point this out. So I think this is great from Google, because anything that you can do, some developers are just unaware of it. Mm-hmm. They don't know that they have all these tools at their disposal. Some are like, oh, I'm already doing development. I'm doing design. I'm doing marketing. It's just one more thing, and it's the first thing I can cut if I'm behind schedule or over budget. But others, they're just grateful to know this. And there's labs, there's availability on both Android and iOS for instructionals and sample code. And it really, I don't want to say it's easy, because I'm not a developer, so saying anything about developing is easy makes me feel like that guy. But it's easier than ever to sort of make your apps as accessible as possible. And Natalia Berdus, she's a phenomenal developer. She spoke at WWDC last year. She will point out that accessibility is really just making things accessible for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's about an app that is incredibly easy for a blind person or a hearing impaired person to use is even easier for someone who's like just a regular or a brand new user or an elderly user, because the elderly are an accessibility group as well. Kids are an accessibility group. It makes it better for everybody in the long run.
Yeah. And we only see the world from our own facet. So this makes it so much easier for developers to take a look at their application and think about it. Well, what if this would be someone that, you know, had Parkinson's, or if this had someone that was blind, or, you know, had someone that was using this application and they weren't able to access colors the same way that other people were. And so this is a great way to be able to see your application through the different facets of different people that may be using it. And that helps us out, because we're almost blind to it. If you haven't walked in someone else's shoes, it's really hard to think about that when you're so busy developing other things at the same time and trying to hit deadlines. And so I think that it's a wonderful idea.
It's accessibility shaming. It's awesome.
I thought about it in a positive way, but
I should say, Natalia calls it inclusivity, not accessibility, and she thinks that just makes people more invested in it.
Huh. Interesting. Well, up next, why are so many online comments full of hate and garbage? But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter for sponsoring this episode. Gone are the days of walking in off the street and filling out a job application to get hired. But fear not. ZipRecruiter wants to be your solution for getting hired and for finding the right people to work for you. ZipRecruiter is the fastest way to hire great people, and you can create your free employer account now. You want to spend more time growing your business and less time endlessly searching through resumes of people who are not suited for your open positions. As a business owner, your company is only as good as the people you hire. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates, and short staffing leaves little time to post to dozens of job sites. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 12 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, you'll see qualified candidates who you will want to hire. ZipRecruiter also includes built-in social recruiting. Take advantage of integrated social network posting to reach job seekers on Facebook or Twitter or Google+. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses, and you can try it now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Scott is a happy ZipRecruiter client, and he said the recruiting process used to be so painful. Before, I'd post to several places, get a million resumes, but only a few responses from qualified candidates. It was torture. But with ZipRecruiter, we post once and get qualified candidates in one easy-to-review place. We've hired some of our best employees using ZipRecruiter. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. So today, another post on Engadget caught my eye. The tech site is shutting down their comments section. It's only for a week, but I thought the piece describing the shutdown was definitely worthy of discussion. So joining us today from Engadget is Terrence O'Brien, Managing Editor, and Amber Bauman, Community Content Editor. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming on. So, Terrence, let's start with you. What prompted the shutdown?
Well, a couple of different things. I'm sure anybody who's ever visited the internet before is familiar with the general population of trolls that is out there. And just recently on some posts, things had kind of started to get a little bit out of hand. In particular, we run a sex and romance column. Some of the responses were a little bit homophobic, a little bit abrasive and aggressive, and just basically super ignorant. And this is not specific to his post, but this was one of the things that sort of spurred this move forward. This has been, unfortunately, ongoing as we've branched out and started covering diversity in tech a lot more recently and stuff like that.
Yeah, I definitely see that on all the sites. Whenever anyone talks about diversity or women's issues, it's often that's where the comments get to be the worst. So, Amber, how much time were you spending on managing the comment section?
On a daily basis, you're talking about easily an hour or two a day in the morning. And then probably I would check in about every 20 minutes or so throughout the day to see new comments that had appeared, to bust the spam bots, to respond to somebody who had said something that was incorrect, or to thank a reader on the comments where they pointed out an error that we had made. So it became increasingly time intensive.
Yeah. I mean, so did you try responding to comments at all?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole reason of comments is to have a dialogue with our readers, and we want that dialogue. So I try to respond to comments when I can. In the case of Chris's article in particular, those responses became increasingly vitriolic and contentious to the point where it just became kind of untenable, even when both of us were responding in real time.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke on Twitter with Carrie, who is on your network, does a show on your network, because I've seen her when she'll respond to her YouTube comments, when YouTube, as we all know, is part of often the worst place for this. But she was really inspiring because, you know, people would be saying things that, you know, were not so kind, and she would respond. She was funny. And, you know, so, and, you know, to what extent, I mean, that it's frustrating because sometimes that works. Sometimes people are surprised, like, hey, you're a real human being. I had no idea. But then sometimes you have to have another solution. So is there any technology? Is there a new technology that you're trying to help solve this problem?
Well, there are a variety of different softwares that have been rolled out. Civil is a more recent software that requires commenters to vote on other comments before they're permitted to submit their own comment. There are a couple others that I'm looking into and researching to try and see what different types of things they're trying to do as far as making comments a friendlier place for everybody to participate. I know that when you look at Medium posts, they don't have a comment section so much as they have annotations that appear next to the text. So there are a variety of different softwares and solutions that people are trying to roll out to various different articles in order to solve this problem. But in the end of the day, there's not really ever a substitute for human moderation.
Yeah, and that's not really feasible and to that extent.
It's time intensive. It's work intensive. And there's an emotional cost, too. I mean, when you spend your entire day literally kind of up to your waist in trolling comments or such negativity, it's hard to then continue on your day and feel positive about your community or contribute stuff as a writer when you know all the blowback that you're going to get for all your pieces.
So, Terrence, do you think this has it been getting worse?
Yeah, I'd say yes and no. This is not the first time we've turned off comments at Engadget. And again, this is a temporary thing. We'll turn them back on. And, you know, there's plenty of other avenues for our readers to communicate with us. We can't turn off comments on Facebook. You can still message us on Twitter. And we even have Public Access, which is a platform for our readers to publish their own content that's, you know, broader and bigger than just commenting on an existing article, where they can share their own opinions in a more full-fledged format. So there's still plenty of avenues for people to talk and communicate with each other. But every so often, it just seems that the comments get progressively worse and they start to deteriorate. And I think, you know, part of it goes to this thing, the best tool, the best, there is no replacement for, you know, human moderation. But people get tired of the trolls. And what happens is, over the course of time, the trolls start to push out the more reasonable voices, the nicer voices. And, you know, I've had plenty of conversations with readers, and readers who are very aggressive or very negative to start. But usually once you engage them in conversation, they come around, they'll, you know, have a reasonable debate with you, or, you know, even apologize sometimes if they do realize that they've kind of got out of hand or said something that they shouldn't have and attacked somebody. But for whatever reason, what's happened here and what has happened before is just those people are getting shouted down by the ones who won't listen to reason. And this is sort of like, we're just doing a pause, let everybody step back. Hopefully the trolls will move on to someplace else. Or, you know, just get off the internet in general, but we know that'll never happen. And, you know, everybody can come back, feel refreshed, and maybe feel a little bit better about trying to engage in conversation again, as opposed to just saying to themselves, well, normally I'd comment on this, but I don't want to anymore because I just know somebody's going to hurl insults at me or threaten me or whatever.
So as an editor, have you considered, like, stopping writing about diversity or inclusion? Has that ever been on the table, like, to start, like, to change your content because of the situation?
Absolutely not. But 100%. I mean, our job at Engadget is to talk about the ways that technology impacts us and how it relates to our culture in the most important ways and how it reflects us as a society. And those are important issues to address. If it makes some people uncomfortable, if there's, you know, some white guys out there who think that somehow we're keeping them down by writing about how there isn't enough women or minority representation in the tech industry, I'm really sorry. But, you know, you're plenty represented. Your voice has been heard. Don't worry about it.
So, Georgia, this is a question for you. I sometimes wonder if, you know, I have this image often when I get the worst kind of troll comments that it's, you know, some 40-year-old man in his mother's basement. But I think that a lot of these people might be young people who are figuring out how to be people, and they don't know yet. It's not that they're sociopaths. My husband's a high school teacher, and he said, to some extent, all high school kids are sociopaths just because you haven't learned yet how to be a person. So do you think that's a lot of what's going on here?
I think that it's multifold. So, yes, I think that a lot of the comments are just young kids blowing off steam, angry, and wanting to get a reaction. And so a lot of times someone just doesn't understand the effect that they have. Often when we've replied to comments, they're like, I'm so sorry, I didn't even know that, you know, you even cared or even read the comments. I was just angry, lost my job, and you were the first face that I saw. And so I blew off steam with that. And I think that in a lot of other cases, we've been, our culture right now has been rewarding reactivity and demagoguery. And so the loudest, most angry voice is the one that everyone responds to, and they're wanting to have this outlet to lash out at society or, you know, a certain set of people. And so they're able to, because right now the internet allows you to be anonymous to it and not accountable for those actions. And because of that, there's no cost. There's no cost. They can get away with it. They can then make another account. And so they get this area where they can feel safe at being angry. And it's a lot of people that are dealing with some very serious issues, and it's not going to get better from just, you know, yelling at the internet, but for a moment, they feel a decrease in their levels of stress hormones because of that. And so it works for them.
Now, Amber, in the article, you explained that this wasn't censorship. Can you talk a little bit about what you heard from readers that made you have to add that this wasn't censorship?
Well, I do a lot of research as the community content manager about other types of comment systems, other places where comments have been shut down, and the reader reaction to that. And it seems as though often the reaction is, you don't want to hear our voices, you're just shutting down your ears, this is censorship. And Engadget's comment system isn't the entire internet, is the thing. It's our house. It's where we live. And if you want to fight or cause a ruckus, you can go outside and do that. You can go to anywhere else on the internet, Twitter or Facebook or your own personal blog. We're not actually silencing your voice. We're trying to show you what is and is not appropriate behavior in our house. And the rules are different on our website because we're creating a community and we get to set those guidelines.
So, Renee, you have an online community, iMore. Have you experienced similar problems?
Oh, yeah. I mean, iMore's on the internet. Yeah, absolutely. And the internet is, at its core, a giant complaint engine. And we're a little bit different than Engadget because we principally cover Apple and Apple-related companies. We don't have the wide variety of different platforms and technologies that they cover. And we still have people who don't use Apple products coming on the comments every day telling us how terrible we are. And not, like, to quote the West Wing, which I always do, it's not just that they dislike the stuff, they dislike the people who like the stuff. And it's supremely challenging. And we try, you know, Georgia led by example very early on. She said, you know, if you can engage, you can turn around some of these people. And we have. We point out that we're human and that what they say has an effect on us. But the combination of anonymity and the internet is super powerful. And you just have to remember that you're not really in there. And I don't know if we've seriously talked about shutting off comments because we were founded as a forum and we kind of grew from that. And communities, the core of what the people who started iMore and Android Central and Windows Central, it was what they hold dear and what they think makes us, you know, different and unique. And they don't want to end that. But at the same time, you sort of look at them every day and it is work to go through them. And no matter how good you are and how engaging you are, and if you do manage to get some on your side, there's 300 more of them right behind. So I am supremely – my favorite, quite frankly, was when Engadget did disemboweling. I thought that was a brilliant response to a lot of this.
And what Amber was saying, it's so true. It's a cost to the person that has to moderate this and deal with all this vitriol every day. You end up with this return of investment of you're trying to make your area for other people to have honest dialogue safe for them. But it's a huge cost to moderators to have to hear horrible comments.
They're saying monkey poop in your house. That's what they're doing.
Constantly. And it's a never-ending fight that some days you're like, it's a really hard battle to fight. So it's something that right now is probably going to get worse for a little while before it gets better.
Oh, and to be crystal clear, I mean, absolutely. Like, there's no freedom of speech involved here. You can't force NBC to air the sitcom that you make in your basement. You can't force the New York Times to publish your diatribe.
Sitcom.
You're a guest on that publishing system. You can go make your own blog and publish whatever you want, but when you're on somebody else's, you should be on your guest behavior.
Yeah, it's not a democracy.
Well, this was already said, but I'll repeat it, that you're only turning them on for a week, which I think is a great solution. Just like everybody take a breather. Maybe people will move on.
It's a timeout.
Yeah, a timeout. Exactly. And I love this because I think that so many, especially the larger tech companies, are reticent to do anything like this because more troll traffic is often just more traffic. Like if you have a crazy fight going on in your comments section, a lot of people might go there. And so, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, but, you know, while Google might not, you know, if someone comes screaming and yelling in their front door, they're going to escort them out of the door. But, you know, if they're in a chat room somewhere and, you know, there's advertising that is making money of people going to those pages, they're not so likely to do that. So I definitely applaud this and I hope you come up with some kind of solution. So thank you so much for joining us, Amber Bauman and Terrence O'Brien. Amber, where's the best place to follow your work online?
If you want to find me, you can go to the public access page. I moderate that, and I encourage everybody to sign up. And if you want to contribute and talk to us about technology, that's a great avenue for that. I'm going to put up a post later today. I'm also on Twitter, and you can find all of us at Twitter. We'll keep putting up as content, and we want to interact with people as best we can.
And how about you, Terrence? How can people contact you?
Best place to reach out to me is probably on Twitter. I'm at Terrence O'Brien, lots of E's, no A's. I will respond to you if you feel like trolling me on the internet, probably anyway.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Take care. So now is the time in the show where we hear from you. Moshe from Baltimore writes, yesterday Jason was wondering why Google hasn't made an Echo-like device until now. Can it be that they didn't think they would be able to sell it because people would have a whole Google is listening to my entire life freak out? I think that's entirely possible. I know when they just released their router, the OnHub router that no one seems to really have bought, they didn't have a microphone in it because I think they were exactly afraid of that. What do you guys think about why Google hasn't come up with an Echo-like device yet?
So, I mean, I think there's a lot of, and I'm oversensitive to this, like people say Amazon Echo is fantastic and it's better at all the voice technology than Google and Siri. But Amazon Echo is solving a very small set. It is available in one country, primarily in one language, where things like Google Now and Siri are available in many countries and handle many languages. Like I can't talk to Echo in Chinese. I can't talk to it if I move to England, if I live in England. So it's a wonderful technology, but they chose an incredibly small subset to sort of hone this on. Apple TV, for example, can't do everything that the Echo can do, but you can actually ask it to play something that is, like I can say, s'il vous plaît, montre-moi Dukes of Hazzard, and it can parse that they started that in French and then continued it in English. And Google's doing similarly really cool things. So when you have an international community and multi-language, it's very hard to just drop a product in and say, we're going to handle this set of things too. You're solving a completely different set of problems. So I think they're all working towards this, and I think they're going to have different approaches. Google obviously is not shy about privacy, and they want Google Shopping to be integrated into this. And eventually they want you to ask your router to bring you a driverless car. So definitely going to get there, but they probably want to launch with a really good, really solid product. And likewise, Apple's whole thing right now is privacy and security, and they're making a point of you have to physically press and hold down a button to even talk to your Apple TV so you don't think that it's listening when you're sort of singing, you know, Risky Business style first thing in the morning. So they're all coming at it from a different angle, but I think we will all end up with similar products, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that Google does have a little bit of the creep factor. People do not trust Google as much when you think about Google Glasses and how, you know, it was easy to videotape people, but that doesn't stop Google. Google does not mind. They're definitely going to be developing something, but it's going to take a little bit more time than that. And so we'll eventually see it, and people will purchase it in the end. People will buy whatever makes it easy for them. And unfortunately, we will often give up our privacy and security for ease of use. So we are more lazy than we are privacy secure. I now, for many 2 years, I said that I'm never going to use my fingerprint detector on my iPhone because I didn't want to have my fingerprint on the phone. And then eventually I said I'm going to use it for a week. And now I can't go back.
They got you.
They got me. It's horrible. My life of crime is ruined, Megan. I have to like file off my fingerprints at some point in time.
That's sad. Maybe you just need to become an internet troll, Georgia.
Okay. And not to go too far off topic, but Google has had, there was an interesting article in The Information where they were showing that the branch of Google which might handle this, which is their next branch, is sort of having some inner turmoil over product direction. I think that's probably slowed them down, so they're way behind where they want to be on this.
Yeah, I think that the Nest Group is so disorganized that from what I read in the Information article, they're not even going to be the one. They are developing a new Echo-like device, but not from Nest. Like, it's going to be another team. But
yeah, and Tony probably threw 5 or 6 prototypes against the wall over the last 18 months to get them to that point.
Yeah. Well, Renee, I'm always impressed when you describe how automated your home is and how you have Siri do your bidding all the time. I don't understand how you do it because she doesn't tend to listen to me, but I am impressed.
So. I just say, Siri, where are my purple lights? And it works. Like, I figure if you can say, where is my super suit? It'll just listen to you.
Okay, maybe I need to use that voice.
Thanks. You have to practice.
Good tip. Okay. Well, after the break, Renee will show off all his new Apple stuff, and Georgia will talk about care kits from a doctor's perspective. But first, let's take a minute to thank Igloo, the sponsor of this episode. Anyone who has worked in a corporate environment knows how painful legacy intranets can be. The content is old and stale, the interface is ugly, and you can only access it at work. Igloo has a better solution to your old-fashioned, rickety, smelly intranet. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. It's built using responsive design, which means everything you can do at your desk, you can now do on the go through any web browser. And anyone can add content based on their permissions with drag-and-drop widgets and a WYSIWYG editor. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Salesforce or SharePoint, Active Directory, and coming soon, file-sharing solutions like Box and Dropbox. It's great for growing companies and large enterprises looking to refresh their communication strategy. It's used by government agencies and companies like Hulu, Inventive Health, American Family Insurance, and Ipswich. Try it free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT, and we thank them for their support. All right, so CareKit is a new open source framework that Tim Cook says will revolutionize healthcare. What do you think about it from your perspective, from a doctor's perspective, Georgia?
So I was so excited. Out of everything that was shown, I was like, oh, you know, bands, those are nice. But this got me so excited because when I'm working with someone, the hardest thing is to get good data from them, to have them actually work on what they're dealing with. And CareKit is exactly what I want from an application to help the people that I'm working with. Because we are notoriously bad at being accurate. We think that this is the way that we felt, and that's often not the case. Unfortunately, our brains most often lie to us. They tell us what we want to hear at the time that we want to hear it. And that just makes it very difficult to give really good care for someone that might be depressed, someone that may be very anxious. And I'm dealing with medications that we want to see what's working, what isn't working. Is the exercise helping? Are you actually exercising? And so often people will come in and tell me what I want to hear or want to please me, but I really just want to know the truth. And CareKit does this. It will allow me to create a care card, which will let people track their individual plan of action. It'll let them be able to deal with their symptoms. Today, you know, I did exercise and I felt pretty good about it. I was feeling really down. And the wonderful thing is then they can send that to me real time. So I can then, if they have a really rough day, I can find out. And then I can send them a modification of what they need to do. And they can send me diagrams. And then I can have all of this really great data, this data that happened real time. And then I can truly help them and not have to worry. Because you don't feel as worried about being judged when you're working with it's just you alone with your phone. And so I think that this is going to change and allow doctors and psychotherapists to be able to really help people and understand what's going on and what isn't going on. So I don't have to worry that, you know, if they have a really down day, but they were seeing their in-laws, I'll be like, oh, it wasn't that the medication isn't working. You were seeing your in-laws. And every time you happen to see your in-laws, you're having some really rough days. That's important data for me, because then I know that. And we could stick on a medication that might be working and change one that may not.
Stop seeing your in-laws. So
save your money. Just don't see your in-laws. That's the mode from this.
So what about privacy? I mean, that's a lot of information to have on your phone, in addition to what we already have on their phones. I mean, do you think, right. How do you think CareKit, do you trust CareKit with privacy, private information?
You see, now, if Apple's going to fight the FBI, I still think you have to be careful with what you put onto your phone. But with, you know, if Apple's going to continue to fight for our privacy, I feel safe in using that. And I think that there is a certain amount of risk to, you know, how your moods are and how you're feeling. But I think that the gain in dealing with, you know, depression and anxiety and being able to live your life, that is a worthwhile risk as long as we do have a, you know, a secure enclave that has all the information that's going to be kept in that. And so it's definitely something that we have a certain amount of risk. But if they wrote this on paper, there's also a certain amount of risk. And I think that we have to kind of take a look at that. But it's another reason why privacy issues are so vastly important. And I'm happy that Apple is fighting for our rights to that.
And will there be like HIPAA compliance issues with this?
That's going to be really interesting. So that's, you know, to do no harm and to make sure that everyone is secure. I think that each doctor will have to take a look at how they feel about, you know, what is the cost versus what is the benefit. Also, we have to take a look that some people may not know how to use, you know, their phones. They may not be able to deal with that. They may, you know, not have the money to be able to afford a phone. So this is also only dealing with a certain select amount of your population that you're dealing with. But I think that for most doctors, they feel comfortable with using that. And already doctors use iPads, and most of the information on files is kept and sent electronically. So we're already dealing with those issues as well.
Now, do you use a lot of apps in your practice now, like apps that might say, like, you know, just tap here if you're happy, and, you know, during those kinds of things? Do you have apps that you use with your patients now?
I haven't really found that there's been a lot of people that have liked certain applications. And my problem with it is that often what the application asks for is not what I am looking for directly. And so it becomes really difficult for me to go on board. So I do use certain applications that deal with meditation or deal with breathing techniques. But even for that, it's not directly what I am looking for. And so usually I make up my own plan and I send it out to that. So if something is specifically for anxiety, people that are dealing with anxiety, and I know that it's secure, and I like the way that CareCut has it set up, that makes it a little bit more interesting to me than just any application that I don't know, you know, where this information is going and which servers they're being stationed on, or is it, you know, going directly only to me. And I think that that's a really important issue to deal with.
Well, before the break, I said you were going to show off some of your new products, Renee, but now I actually didn't ask if you had them with you or not. I know you reviewed the iPhone SE. Do you have it there with you?
Aha. Tiny, tiny little rose gold phone.
And Georgia, do you have your 6S rose gold to compare
the size? I do. Here we go. I'll hold the little one.
And yours is just, is yours the plus or just the 6?
Yes.
Yours is the plus. So plus. That's a lot bigger.
Yeah. It's a lot bigger.
Yeah, this looks like the other one's car.
I almost couldn't find this phone. It was on the table and I couldn't see it. But wow, like single finger moving around the screen. Amazing. Amazing. That's like the thing. And the button on the top. Now I'm pressing it on the side. I'm like, where's the button?
Johnny, I've got you.
Why isn't it turning off? And it's on the top again.
Georgia, you know you're
just got used to.
I know you're not allowed to upgrade to that. We talked about this. Remember? You said you were a 2-year upgrader, and then you upgraded in a year. It hasn't even been 4 months.
I, you know, it's horrible. I think that it's partially it's the color. It's just so pretty.
Yeah, that's why they do it.
And you see, I'm a little bit superficial, unfortunately, to that. So this time I did. Rarely do I, but I'm going to be upgrading again as well. How about
interesting?
You?
No, I'm not going to be upgrading.
You're not going to do it?
I don't know.
You're so good.
Yeah. Well, I like the size of mine. So Renee, what do you think so far? Is the battery life better? Is it faster? What do you like about it?
Yeah. So basically, the iPhone SE is an iPhone 5S in shape, but they've completely redone it. Like the back, it looks like an iPhone 6 now. It's got the 6000 series aluminum, the inset stainless steel. But on the inside, you have a combination of 6S and 6 parts. So like the chipset is the A9, which is super fast. It feels like one of those super leggere cars where they just left the same engine but took out all the weight from it, like the extra seats, everything. So it's got low resolution. It just flies. I mean, it's like not low, but a smaller screen. So it really goes super fast. The radios are good. The camera, it's got the same EyeSight camera as the iPhone 6S. So 12 megapixels, 4K video. I like the plus size phone. I'm not going to lie. I use it like a tiny tablet, but this thing is a Ducati. It is a high performance motorcycle. It's amazing.
And do you miss 3D touch?
Yeah. I mean, I trained myself to use 3D touch. So on this one, for example, for live photos, you touch and hold instead. And I do find myself pressing and my brain going, just press harder and maybe a miracle will happen. So I do miss that. The front-facing camera is the same as a 5S. So it's got the new chipset intelligence, but the camera is still lower resolution. And our faces deserve high-resolution cameras, Megan. That's just the truth.
I think I look better on low res.
So there are a few things. And the modem, the speeds, the internet speeds are as fast as the iPhone 6, not the 6S Plus. So you have LTE Advanced 150, and you have Wi-Fi that maxes out at 433 instead of 866 like the 6S. So there's a few things that aren't quite up to snuff, but... I mean, it's the same as this. This is the new tiny iPad Pro. That some things, you know, it's not as big, but it's got a lot of stuff on the inside that's really cool. So you've got more decisions to make now.
I think that Leo did order us the what I'm calling now the Baby Pro. Is that what we call it? The Baby Pro? The
Serenity started that. And yeah, she totally has taken over the internet with this. So here's the Baby Pro with the keyboard and everything.
Okay, here's the question. Is there room for your hands on the keyboard?
I typed with it. I do have tiny hands. I typed with it, and I could use it and touch type quite quickly. Unfortunately, I search still for a trackpad, which I will never find, which I find very frustrating. And then I want to reach out and touch the screen. And it's lovely in that it's really light and it fits really beautifully with it. But I'm still searching for
it. It took me about 5 minutes. I used it on the entire plane ride home. It took me about 5 minutes to get used to it. Apple's never made a keyboard this small before, but I used keyboards on my iPad Air. I've used keyboards on my iPad Mini, and I've used them on my iPhone. You get kind of used to it after a while. Your brain is wonderfully malleable and it adapts pretty quickly if it has no other choice. It's only when we're given choice that we rebel.
So the Baby Pro is also supposed to be less reflective. That was the thing that they touted at the event. Do you see a difference between if one's a baby, what's the 12-inch iPad Pro? Mama? Daddy? What do you call the big one?
Daddy Pro.
So I mean, like, the screen technology here is fantastic. It's got a DCI P3 display, which is the same color gamut. It just means it can show more colors as a cinema projector or the new 5K iMac. But it's also 25% more saturation, 25% brighter, and 40% less reflective. So anytime you have a backlit display, obviously the sun always wins. The sun is just so bright, it always wins. But this does the best job fighting it so far that I've ever seen on something that's not like an e-ink display.
So I didn't hear you have any complaints about the bigger iPad Pro before. Are you going to replace it for the littler one?
So here's the thing, like if you're all in, like I know Serenity is going to stay with the 12.9-inch because she's basically replaced her Mac with it, and that makes it the full-on computer. I still use my Mac for some things, mostly because I have so much muscle memory and I'm just so used to certain workflows. So I'm carrying a MacBook with me. So instead of carrying a MacBook and a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, I'm going to be carrying a MacBook and a 9.7-inch iPad Pro, at least for now, so I can see what I need. Like you have to commit to a 12.9-inch iPad Pro. You got to want it. But this one, 9.7 inches, it looks so tiny now by comparison. It's like I can just throw it, and I love to draw. I just love the pencil. I'm addicted to it. And having this sort of notebook-sized drawing surface is just Jordy's going to draw now, make me jealous. It's just
so. It is a great experience. And that's what people want. Like a lot of people wanted to have the portability and the ability to draw at the same time, and this just finishes that.
So I was panicked when Snapchat bought Bitmoji, so I thought I would quickly start drawing to see if I could make up for it.
Do you think Snapchat's going to ruin Bitmoji? We didn't talk about that story.
I think it's going to, your emoji's going to last for a day and then be destroyed.
Oh. I'm so sad. I'm going to save them all as pictures so I can still send them out.
Can we talk about one more thing though, Megan?
Yes.
Because I am so, I am so done.
Renee, go show them all.
I just have one that I'm going to return.
I can't. The new leathers, the new modern buckles. I mean, there's just Apple. Why are you doing this to me?
Have you counted them all? How many Apple Watch bands do you have, Renee?
I didn't count. I just bought more, so now my math is bad. I can use that as an excuse. I think maybe 20 at this point.
So that's why I'm so sad, Megan, that he doesn't have the same watch face as I do, because then I could have just pinched them when he wasn't looking.
Yeah. So I have the royal blue nylon, and I have the space gray watch, and I tried them. I'm going to return it because although it was very soft and the nylon felt very good on my wrist, I thought it was a little bit too thin. Like I wanted it to be a wider band. Did you have that issue or is that just me?
No, I'm not wearing mine now. I'm wearing the new space black Milanese because it's kind of cool. It's like Game of Thrones on your wrist. But I was wearing the I think it's pink and something. Woven nylon band for 2 or 3 days. And I really liked it because it was so light. I like the sports band, but sometimes the sports band, you just want something different. And this is also super inexpensive. Like you said, super light, super breathable. So I was really happy with it. I know some people in general think the bands are too narrow, but I've always had narrow bands. I guess I didn't even think about it on my watches. So they've just seemed normal to me.
Yeah. So Georgia, do you have a third party band or is that the modern buckle that you have on your...
So I have a third-party band right now, but I'm going to be switching to the black woven band. And so, there's I don't mind that it's really light and kind of thinner, but I'm still waiting for a more elegant band for when I go out. That's what I've been really waiting for.
Elegant is code for Swarovski crystal, by the way.
I could do crystal. That's okay.
Well,
but yes, I want a really girly band so that when I go out, I can wear a nice sleek dress and wear my Apple Watch as well. I was always really sad that I have to choose between my watch or looking a little bit funky while I'm on the dance floor.
She wants a Gem in the Holograms watch is what she's saying.
Yeah.
I've admired your third party band, that leather band, for a long time. And that's the size, like, that's what I'm talking about. I like how thick it is. It's just, I don't know, but it's a personal preference.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for showing off all of the new products that you have. I guess they were available to start ordering yesterday if anyone wanted to order them, and arrival for regular people around March 31st.
Yes.
So let's talk about TNT's fan of the day, who's Andrew Lesmerises on Twitter, who says he watches while waiting for class on his CarPlay Ready radio. That's pretty nice. And that's just also a picture of Andrew, I assume. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we are going to find it. After the break, Renee and George, I hope you'll stick around to talk to me a little bit about how artificial intelligence is not smarter than us yet. But
not smarter than you two.
Not yet. But first, let's take a minute to thank Ring, the sponsor of this episode. Now, I never thought much about my doorbell. It did what it was supposed to do. You pressed it. I heard it inside. I came to the door. I never thought I could expect more from it. But then I got the Ring video doorbell, and my doorbell became a way for me to keep tags on my house, on my kids, the packages that people leave at my door. I can even see and talk to my dog while I'm at work. And I do that, even though it took him a while to get used to hearing me talking through the doorbell. Now he likes it. With the Ring video doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't even ring the doorbell. With Ring video doorbell, you can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your package. If someone tries to mess with it, you'll get an instant alert and an HD video of the whole thing. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. If you have someone working on your house, you can talk to them when they get there. You can see when they get there and when they leave. It's great. Installing Ring takes minutes. It works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with a video doorbell, Time Magazine, and USA Today, named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/TNT for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/TNT with Ring. You are always home. So over the past few days...
I use a Ring at my house.
Oh, you do?
It's amazing. I do. I love it. I love being able to answer the door and you can stay in bed.
Now, how come you don't answer when I ring?
Oh, wasn't working that day.
I hope you've notified your babysitters. That was the first thing that I forgot to do. Like, oh, by the way, you know, if you're walking by the door, I'm going to be able to see you. So it's a good thing to notify everyone that is going to be at your house that they are being recorded. So all this week, we've been talking about Microsoft's new chatbot. Today, they officially apologized for not training it better. And it of any story that we heard this week, it really highlighted for me the importance of the humans in developing AI. There were also headlines this week claiming that a Japanese AI wrote a novel and almost won a literary prize. An article in Slate points out that these claims were a bit exaggerated. The computer only wrote 20% of the novel. Japan News says humans chose the plot and the gender of the characters, and the AI selected words or sentences prepared by humans. Really, it just reworked a novel that had already been written. So I have talked at length about Tay, the chatbot, but what do you guys think about this whole debacle that happened on Twitter over the week with this mistreatment?
Thank you for contacting us, Megan. How can we help you with your request?
This is the reason that you teach your children about the internet before you let them on the internet. Unfortunately, it's not that great of a place. And when you right away let people know that there's a bot that's going to be using the information that you give it, people are going to want to troll this bot and see what happens. And that's exactly what occurred. So I think that it was an interesting experiment, and it probably taught us a little bit more about human nature than it did about AI.
I definitely think, or you know, a lot of people were saying like, oh, this teaches me so much about society. And but it's like, it's really not society. Like, we have to remind everyone that Twitter is not the same as society, right? I mean, there are...
What? Hold on, wait.
I only speak in 140 characters.
And yeah, I say what other people said and call it a retweet. That's just my thing.
I do a lot of retweeting. Wait.
So burned. We're identifying ourselves as bots all over the place.
Yeah.
Did either of you get to play with the bot before it got taken offline?
I was so sad because I was at work and I was doing something. So by the time that it got to me, I found out on Twitter, but by the time that I got to it, because I like tweet out every 12 hours or something like that, it was already gone. And so I was very sad that I didn't get to bot chat.
I don't know. I grew up watching the same movies like The Matrix and Terminator and was taught that eventually this AI stuff is going to rise up against us and eradicate us. So I kind of like this stuff. Anytime that they do poorly and get in trouble, I think it's just we have an extra year left on the human index. And I'm sort of super happy about that.
But that's the big question, right? Is it the humans that failed or the AI that failed in this situation?
It's always the humans. Every system would be perfect if not for us humans. Boy, we should do something about us humans.
Well, it also shows we're getting better at this for the good and for the bad. We're getting better. Our AI is getting better. It's still a long way to go. But whenever I see Big Dog or I, you know, hear about another computer beating a human at a game, I think, oh, you know, this is going to get really smart. We have to be careful with what we program our computers to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They are learning from us. That's the important thing.
Yes, unfortunately.
All the worst things, too.
Yeah. Yes, they're learning how to play Go and, yes, learning how to be horrible on Twitter. So
I'm sure Skynet is a shaman on World of Warcraft as we speak. I mean, it's got to be.
Well, Georgia and Renee, thank you both so much for coming and joining me today. Tell people a little bit about, I guess let's talk about the iMore podcast. Like I said, it's my Saturday morning ritual to listen to. What am I going to get to listen to tomorrow?
Well, so we recorded early this week because we were at the event.
Oh, you did.
So
I already listened to it live. I don't get another
one? Myself, Trinity Caldwell, Daniel Bader, and Lori Gill were all at the hotel across the street from Apple, and we recorded immediately. So we'll probably do another show next week, and then... I'm sorry, I disappointed you and ruined your Saturday.
Yeah, because I already listened to it the other day. And it's great, by the way. Serenity talks about Care Kit as well and talks about it from, her getting her physical therapy and using that and looking forward to being able to use it for those sorts of things. So it's definitely a good listen. Where can everybody follow you? Where's the best place to follow you, Georgia, online?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm not a bot. It's at Georgia_Tao.
Bot-like tendencies.
Bot-like tendencies. And also you can check me out on anxiety-videos.com.
And what about you, Renee? Where's the best place to follow you?
You can find me at Renee Ritchie on Twitter. And you can find me every Tuesday with Leo, Andy, Alex, and friends on Mac Break Weekly.
Well, thank you so much. We'll see you guys soon.
Thanks.
Take care. So Jason is still out on Monday, but I will be joined by Selena Larson and Scott Johnson. Tech News Today records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can watch it. You can also be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV. You can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnt. And if you want to find me on Twitter, I am at Megan Maroney. Thank you to our technical director, Kara, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. Thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you on Monday.